Okay, so we are having a look at dependent origination, of course, and we have had a look at the first factor of avijja and what that means. There's much more that could be said about avijja because the depth of misunderstanding obviously is quite profound from a worldling's point of view. And one of the things I haven't talked about very much, but which of course is quite important, is also the idea of anatta, non-self. That, of course, is very is perhaps the most fundamental of all the delusions or misunderstandings of the putujana, of the ordinary person, to feel that there is a sense of self inside, right? This is one of the basic problems. And that is, in a sense, if you look at the Four Noble Truths, that is also understood by the First Noble Truth of dukkha. Anatta, anicca, is part of that, an aspect of that. Where there is dukkha, there is also, there's no self. It's impermanent, because impermanent is dukkha, because it's impermanent and dukkha, there is no self. So this is a part and parcel of the same thing here. And I will be using this idea that anatta is part of avijja to explain how avijja transfers into the sankharas. I will be looking at that very soon, actually, here. But I'm not going to talk anything much more about avijja right now. What I want to look at now is the causality that is implied. I want to look at the causality of where avijja comes from. What are the conditions that give rise to avijja or strengthen avijja, etc. And I want to look at how avijja, in turn, gives rise to the sankharas through conditionality here. So, there's a little extract here of a sutta from the Anguttara Nikaya 10, and I will have a look at the full sutta later on during this retreat, but now just this little extract just to show this particular point of where avijja comes from. Because it is said the first point of craving for existence is not seen such that before this there was no craving for existence and afterwards it came into being. Still, craving for existence is seen to have a specific condition. I say because that craving for existence has a nutriment. It is not without a nutriment. And what is the nutriment for craving for existence? It should be said, ignorance, avijja. Avijja too, I say, has a nutriment. It is not without nutriment. And what is the nutriment of avijja? It should be said, the five hindrances, the pancha nivarana. So, just a very small sutta, or a very small extract, rather, of a sutta. And there's a number of interesting things about this little extract here, which actually probably worthwhile pointing out. First of all, it talks about craving for existence, and in many ways, the root craving of all cravings is the craving for existence. We're talking about before the three types of craving that lead to rebirth, right? The craving for sensual objects or sensual pleasures, the craving for existence, and the craving for extermination, the vibhava tanha. And of course, of these, the most important one is probably the craving for existence. It's very deeply rooted. You can give up the karma bhava, but the karma tanha, but the bhava tanha will still be there. This is the thing which drives you. Even when the sensuality is abandoned, you go into samadhi, that bhava tanha will still underlie your existence and drive you forward into new existences, into the jhana realms, into the immaterial realms, and all that sort of thing here. So this is kind of the core craving, and that's why it is singled out in this way, right? This is the driver, the ultimate driver of samsara, which drives it forward from life to life, keeping it going, on and on, etc. So what is interesting here is the way the Buddha expresses this, right? He says that a first point of craving for existence, it is not seen. Right? A first point of craving for existence is not seen. And so he is saying that no matter how far back in time, you go back and back. You know, remember the Buddha was recollecting his past lives, right? So you go back a long way. And as you go back and back and back, there is no first point to be discerned. And it's very interesting the way the Buddha phrases this, because usually in most religions and philosophies, people will say things like, there is no beginning, right? There is no, it just goes back forever, there is no beginning here. But what the Buddha says instead of saying there is no beginning, he says no beginning can be found. And there is a massive difference between that, because to say that there's no beginning is like a speculation. You can never actually see that for yourself. Perhaps you could infer it if the certain conditions were right. It's possible, but the Buddha doesn't seem to say that. All he says, no beginning can be seen. And this is it's an interesting point. It shows you the Buddha as a pragmatist. The Buddha is not somebody who speculates or has all kind of big theories about things. He looks at the world and then he explains the world to you as he sees it. This is what I have seen. And he doesn't exaggerate. What he says is exactly the way things are. An interesting point, apparently, is that when this was translated into Tibetan, because remember these suttas were translated into all kind of languages in ancient times, into Chinese, it was existed in all the Indian languages, Sanskrit, all of that. When it was translated into Tibetan, which was about maybe around 1000 AD or something like that, and you know, the 10th century AD roughly, Buddhism came to Tibet very late, and by that time it had already undergone a lot of corruption, a lot of changes, etc. But from what I understand, I can't read Tibetan, from what I'm told, in the Tibetan translation of this, it says, there is no beginning, right? So there is no beginning. There they have moved from a purely observation, a purely pragmatic statement, to a statement which is speculative, which is called metaphysical, is the word they often use for this kind of statement in Western philosophy. It's a metaphysical statement, a statement that cannot be proven, cannot be known through observation or through experiments or whatever. So this is how the Buddha speaks, and I always, to me, it gives a very strong sense of confidence that somebody doesn't overstep what can be discovered and goes into speculation about things. Anyway, so he says that there's no beginning for craving for existence, right? It just goes back and back and back forever. There's no first point of this. This is like one of the primordial facts of existence, of samsara, this craving to be, I want to exist. Of course, it goes together with ignorance, it goes together with all these other factors of personality as well. So that is interesting in its own right, and we will see some more statements about this later on during this retreat, and we'll have another look at it then, and have a look at some other aspects of that at that point. But then comes the next thing, which is very important for our understanding of dependent arising and for our decisions what to do about it. And that is, even though it has no first point, still it has a specific condition. Right? There are things that are supportive of craving for existence. There are things which kind of give rise to it in a sense. And of course, the craving here for existence is ignorance itself. We were talking about that the other day. We're talking about how, you know, in the Second Noble Truth, usually it's craving that gives rise to rebirth. And then I said, well, it takes it all the way back to ignorance to show you the root cause. And that, in a sense, is what you see here. You see the connection, ignorance, tanha, and then tanha to rebirth and the ongoing samsara as a consequence. And then comes the point which really is interesting as far as what we are doing now is concerned, and that is that the nutriment for ignorance is the five hindrances. Right now you can see the language has changed slightly. It doesn't say the condition or the cause for ignorance. It says the nutriment. This is something that supports ignorance, that feeds it, that can increase it or decrease it, but always feeds it to keep it going. So this is kind of the interesting point here. And this is, of course, very important for our practice, because what it means is that as long as the hindrances are there, ignorance, avidya, delusion, wrong view, not seeing things according to reality, it is supported by these things. And only when these things are completely abandoned is avidya unsupported. It has no nutriment anymore, nothing to hold it up, no foundation. Right? There is one other thing here which, of course, is important. It's not just the five hindrances. It's also your view. If it was just the five hindrances, then anyone who attains samadhi would see reality as it actually is. But it's not enough. The other thing which is important as well is your view. So the hindrances plus your view. So if you come to abandon all the hindrances, but you have wrong view, you think, yeah, wow, this is it. I have discovered God, right? God, now the big Brahma. I've seen the big Brahma. I've seen the Christian God or the Muslim God or whatever it is, right? This is it. Of course, at that point, the view is going to hinder you seeing things according to reality. And this is one reason why samadhi, the way it is defined in the suttas, it is the four jhanas together with the seven other factors of the Noble Eightfold Path. So you have to have right view for it to be real samadhi. If it isn't, you haven't got right view, if right view isn't there together with the samadhi, it's not samadhi. These things have to go together here. So that is this is the way it is. So once you abandon the five hindrances and you have a little bit of right view, at the very least you haven't got wrong view, right? You haven't got some kind of view which is going to block you from seeing anything. Then there is a chance that you will make a breakthrough. You will get that insight when you abandon the five hindrances. This is very, very useful, right? And then, of course, we know that the whole Eightfold Path is really about purifying yourself. It is about abandoning the five hindrances. So you see how this whole thing fits in to the Noble Eightfold Path, the gradual training and all that. Now, this particular sequence, after abandoning the five hindrances, it goes further back. So the support for the five hindrances is the three courses of bad conduct, right, by body, speech and mind. And it goes stage and stage back, back and back and back, until the root cause for avidya again is found. So do you want to guess what do you think the root cause for avidya is? One possibility is avidya itself, but that kind of becomes too circular. So, of course, that is true. The root cause for avidya is not seeing the noble ones, right? Not meeting the Buddha, not having a chance to read the suttas. That is the root cause. And of course, this is one of the reasons why the Buddha famously said that this is 100% of the holy life, to being able to see the noble ones, kalyanamitta, good spiritual friendship. So, right, so when you have the suttas, well, there you are. You are in the presence of the noble ones, just by reading the suttas, that much. And if you're lucky, you even get to meet some noble ones during your life, right? Even better if you can do that. We have a look at that later on, how this whole process starts from not seeing the noble ones, and then that leads to avidya, and then, of course, suffering arises as a consequence. But why is it? Why is it that the five hindrances support avidya, support delusion? What is actually going on there? What is the reason for that? First of all, of the five hindrances, it is always the two first ones that are the most important ones. The most important ones. The first one, of course, being kama chanda, desire for the sensual pleasures of the world. The other one being vyapada, which is ill will. And the other three hindrances, the sloth, the tiredness, the restlessness, and the doubt, they really are mostly a consequence of the first two ones. The first two ones are by far the most important ones. So how is it that they support delusion? And I think it's very easy to understand why that is the case. And just think about yourself, think about when you have some ill will, you have some negativity against somebody, right? And you think, yeah, they deserve to be told off, I must tell them off, right? You're angry, and sometimes when you are angry with somebody, you have negativity with somebody, you overstep the mark, and then you say something, and later on, when you kind of calm down, you feel relaxed again, you feel at ease, you think, wow, I shouldn't have said that, I went too far, you know, I said too much. So why is that? What's going on there? What is going on there is very simple. When you're angry, your mind is deluded. And then when you calm down, you find peace again, you feel relaxed again. That is when you see clearly. And when you see clearly, you understand that it was a mistake that you did when you were angry. So it's very easy to understand how ill will, negativity, anger confuses the mind, deludes the mind, makes it very hard to make rational, proper, good, wise decisions, I should say. And of course, it's exactly the same thing with kama chanda, right? If you have desire, as long as you have desire, you have a vested interest in the objects of the world. If you desire something, if you desire, oh, you like your body, right? Or you're attached to your physical body. Then if you start to do the asubha kamatan, looking at the 32 parts, you find it unpleasant. you find it unpleasant because reality goes against the Kama Chanda. You have a vested interest in seeing the body as beautiful, and if you try to see it as it actually is, the mind will rebel. And you can see that the mind doesn't want to go there, it wants you to hold back. It's a vested interest. Or in the world, you know, sometimes when we want things in the world, you know, you these days people like to do shopping therapy and all this kind of crazy stuff. And you go to the shops, you go out, and you look in the windows, right? And you see some, wow, that looks so nice. I'm talking about the lay people now, mostly. Sometimes the monks do this as well, right? Which is not so good, but anyway, so you... You go past the window and you say, wow, that would be really, I really want that. That would be so nice, so good to have. I really need that. This enormous desire arises, right? You see it in the shopping window. And so you jump in and say, okay, one of those please, and take it back home. And then 2 days later you think, why did I buy that? Right? And this is the way it often goes. It goes because at that point, desire, the marketing of the company has somehow worked its way, wormed its way into your mind and told you that you really need this. This is really important, right? Desire has arisen. And when desire has arisen, your outlook is distorted. When your outlook is distorted, you do stupid things and 2 days later, you regret it. And this is a very, very common experience. So remember that when you have desire, your outlook is distorted. You don't know what you're doing. You're not seeing things according to reality. You have a vested interest in the world as it is not. You have a vested interest in seeing things in the wrong way, in attaching to those things or whatever it is. You don't want to see death. You don't want to see old age, etc., etc. So what that means is that even if there's just a little bit of desire left in your mind, a little bit of karma chanda of these defilements, there will be a little bit of distortion. And as long as there is a little bit of distortion, you will not be able to see things according to reality. You will not be able to eliminate avijja. So you have to abandon the five hindrances completely. And only then is it possible to see things according to reality. Only then is it possible to be truly mindful. Right? Kamachanda, Vyapada, that drag you into the future, that drag you into the past, that pull you around, mess you around, and then one day when it's all abandoned, then you can relax. Then you can see things in the present moment. You can stay with things. You can have samadhi because the mind is no longer being manipulated, pulled around by these defilements. So I think it's important sometimes to ask these kind of questions. Why is it that this is the case? If you understand the whys of this easier, it has a more powerful impact on us. Yes, of course, it has to be this way. And then you start to, you have some more motivation for your practice. Okay, so that is how ignorance is supported by the five hindrances and how that ultimately goes a long way back, all the way back to not really understanding the Dhamma, not understanding things as they actually are. So that is the root of ignorance, how ignorance comes to be. And now, what I would like now is to move forward in the other direction and ask the question is, well, how is it that avidya translates into the sankharas? What is actually going on there? And then try to understand that relationship a little bit and see if that also has some significance for us in our practice. So, first of all here, there is some definitions, and I will just read those definitions out, just so you can see how these things are defined in the suttas. So avidya, ignorance, delusion, is the condition for willed activities. And the willed activities are the condition for consciousness. So that is the factors I'll be looking at now, is avidya to sankhara and then vijnana. But with the remainderless fading away and cessation of avidya comes the cessation of volitional formations, of the willed activities. And with the willed cessation of the willed activities comes the cessation of consciousness. So that is the reverse aspect. And then we have the definitions down here. And what, bhikkhus, are these willed activities? There are three kinds of willed activities: the bodily willed activities, the verbal willed activities, and the mental willed activities. These are called the willed activities. And what, bhikkhus, is consciousness? There are the six classes of consciousness: eye consciousness, ear consciousness, nose consciousness, tongue consciousness, body consciousness and mind consciousness. This is called consciousness. So what is the significance of these definitions? They're not, to be honest, they're not all that interesting, but what they show us, the first one, when it comes to the willed activities, what it means, that all the willed activities, there are no willed activities apart from these three, right? Either it's by body, by speech, or by mind. There's nothing really beyond that. So all willed activities are included in the definition of sankhara here. So it's an all-encompassing view. And it gives us some idea how to look at our life as well, because it is, you know, these are kind of big areas. We speak, we use the body, and we think about things. So it's quite a useful classification in that sense. And then you have the definition of consciousness, six classes of consciousness. Again, the idea here is that all consciousness is included in the definition of consciousness. There is no consciousness apart from this. The sutta, as always, says this is the all, this is the everything there is, these six classes of consciousness. So now, I want to continue a little bit where I left off yesterday. I spent a little bit of time yesterday explaining the link between avidya and sankhara, and then how that affects the mind, and etc. And I want to continue with that today and say something more about it. And one of the things, one of the important points we'll be seeing this morning is that the Four Noble Truths, and the first one in particular, it all revolves around the idea of suffering, right? The Buddha is basically saying we don't understand happiness in the world, we don't understand suffering in the world, we don't really know where these things are to be found. We search for happiness when in fact all what we are doing is looking for suffering. We think we are avoiding suffering when actually what we are avoiding sometimes is happiness itself. Right? So we haven't got a clue, basically, where real happiness is to be found. This is one of the problems. Until you come to the Dhamma, and gradually your view starts to change, and you look in a different place. And because we don't know where happiness is to be found, we look for it in the wrong place, and that is why we want to exist. We have tanha, we want to keep on going, yeah, hooray, keep on going, right? Travel in this wonderful samsara, and keep on going in the in sensual pleasures, you know, more relationships, more holidays overseas, getting a nice house, more entertainment, right? And you can see, if you look at your mind, the majority of people, their whole world, their whole mind is engrossed in that kind of things, completely engrossed in that. And that is really the reason, because they don't understand where happiness is to be found. So we go out pursuing these happinesses, right? And this is what this is all about. And of course, a big part of that is pursuing relationships. A big part of that is making enough money so you can get all of these things in the world that you are interested in, etc. Right? So this is people's life revolve around those things. So you start acting accordingly. And this is where the sankharas are here, come into play from dependent origination point of view. You act accordingly, you think accordingly, you speak accordingly, so you can pursue that happiness that you think is out there, but actually probably is not from a Buddhist point of view. And of course, if you then gradually, if you start to practice the Buddhist path, you start to meditate, and maybe you are enjoying your meditation, right? Your mind is turning around, you're becoming a more wholesome person, you feel more happiness from just being kind, just being generous, just being compassionate to other people. Your meditation is starting to take off, and you see something strange happening in your mind. Your interest is changing. Your interest is moving towards the realm of meditation instead. Instead of fantasizing about relationships, instead of fantasizing about that wonderful car, right? Wow, if, you know, whatever it is, kind of car you want to have, or whatever it is, you start to think about meditation. You start to think, wow, it would be nice to go on a retreat somewhere. It would be nice just to find a kuti in the forest, and all I can do is just meditate all day. And you start to think, and you see something very positive in that. People who are good meditators, they always say, oh, I can't wait to get back to my kuti and just sit down and watch my breath. Right? So your entire horizon, your mental attitude has changed. Your interest is somewhere else. The sankharas are pointing you in a different direction. The sankharas are now always planning, always their aim is to meditate. And that is where you find your happiness instead. There is still some delusion there until you make a final breakthrough, but at least it is kind of going in the right direction. So you can see here how avidya translates into the search for happiness. And for that reason, the doing of things, the building up of sankharas, and this is how we create karma. Now in that search, as we go out into the world and we are searching for happiness, right, looking for the pleasures in the world, as I said yesterday, there's two things that we do. We do good karma and we do bad karma, and we do all kind of karma in between, kind of grey karma. Because of that, because we create karma as a consequence, if somebody gets in our way, we get angry and upset, and maybe we do something bad. However, if we have a good day and other people are cooperating with us, then we are kind and friendly, right? It really depends on how other people are. And then we do the right thing. So we make a mixture of karma in this human realm, sometimes good, sometimes bad. What is important here is, of course, that karma will then affect our mind, as I was saying yesterday. You do something bad, you feel bad about yourself. You do something good, you feel good about yourself. Why is that? Why is it necessary to feel good about yourself just because you've done something good? Why do you feel bad about yourself because you've done something bad? And this is where this idea of non-self comes into the picture here. Right? Not really non-self, but the sense of self that we have, that is where that comes into the picture here. Because of one important aspect of avidya is the sense of self that we have. Right? When you do an act, if you do an act of kindness, you have to own that act. You have to feel responsible. You have no choice because it feels like you did it. You haven't seen non-self. You don't know that there is no ultimate responsibility perhaps in there. But because you haven't seen that, because you think that you exist, because it feels like you are doing these things, you have to own that act. It is yours. I did this. I am responsible. And because you feel responsible for the act, it will affect you what you're doing. Right? So if you feel responsible for a bad act, it means that you think, oh no, I did a bad act, right? And you feel really bad about it. If somebody else tells somebody else about what you've been doing, don't say anything. I don't feel good about this. Be quiet, right? This is how it is. You feel slightly ashamed of what you have done. This is why Hiriyotapa is one of the guardians in the world. The fact that they actually make us feel slightly ashamed when we do something bad. And this is why it has to be like this. You have no choice, precisely because of the sense of self. And if you do a good act, you feel the opposite. You feel, yeah, I did something nice, right? And you feel happy about yourself. And you are lifting up your consciousness, lifting up your mind, feeling elated because you did something right. So this is the way the mind has to be like this, because this comes from the sense of self. And really only when you become a stream mentor, when you see through that, when you understand that ultimately everything is just causality. And when you see that everything is causality, that is why the stream mentor has this absolute ability to forgive themselves. One of the reasons why they can't usually will go to a good destination in a future life. One of the reasons why they can't be reborn in a bad destination. They can't judge themselves in a bad way anymore. They know that it's all causality going all the way, all the way back. One of the things that we often talk about in Buddhism, we often talk about the idea of forgiveness, right? Forgiving ourselves and forgiving others. And of course, that is a very, very important thing. And don't underestimate that. That forgiveness is in part based on the ability to understand that we aren't all that responsible, right? Yes, we are. We did something bad, but ultimately we were, other people influenced us and we were in a difficult situation, all these kind of things. And that helps us to forgive ourselves, to understand our limitations, to understand that we are so conditioned by the things around us. But remember, as long as you have a sense of self, as long as you haven't seen anatta as it properly is, you will never be able to forgive yourself 100%. This is part of the problem. We can forgive, but we cannot forgive completely. And this is the problem. So maybe even if you can forgive yourself 90%, right? There's 10% left there which will say, I did it. I am responsible. I have to suffer the consequences of this. And so you judge yourself in a bad way because of that. Right? Or if you If you did something good, right? Well, in that case, you don't really have to think about anatta. Yeah, you just think atta. I did all of this, right? And you kind of, yeah, I did the right thing. But even then, it's sometimes good to understand that too as anatta. But there is also a natural feeling of happiness when you do what is good. So this is part of the problem. And so these two things come together, right? And this is how we create the kind of the environment in our own mind, when the non-self and all the activities we do come together, and then we accumulate karma on that basis, and we judge ourselves either badly because we do bad things or well because we do good things. And then our consciousness is established accordingly. So you do a lot of bad things, right? And you start to do that, and you accumulate all the bad things. You're lowering yourself down, depressing your mind state, feeling all these bad qualities, feeling unhappy, feeling kind of grey, feeling negative inside. The more bad things you do, the worse you feel about yourself. The more good things you do, you're lifting yourself up, cutting off all those negative things that hold you down, and you start to soar, right? Your mind becomes light, it becomes beautiful, it soars up. You feel light inside, you feel this sense of ease and relaxedness because the mind is soaring up. It's almost like being a balloon. You're adding to the helium, so the balloon becomes lighter and lighter, floating up and floating up. And this is how the mind then kind of gets established in this way as a consequence. And I would recommend you, I think it's a very useful exercise to actually look at how this works out in yourself. It's actually a very powerful thing. Look at how your actions, how your sankharas, every time you do something, right? This is very real. Sankhara, when you read it in dependent origination, it looks like just a word on paper, doesn't have any meaning. Bring it back to reality. Every time you do something, see how it affects you, right? Haven't you felt that when you do something kind, you often feel joy afterwards? You do something very nice to somebody, a kind act, a kind gesture, an act of charity, whatever it is, and afterwards you feel so good inside of you, an act of joy, gladness, because of your kindness. Notice that. Even sometimes all you have to do is think a kind thought about somebody else, and just thinking a kind thought kind of lifts you up and makes you feel better. And when you see that inside of you, when you see the power of your own intentions, your own motivations, it gives you a very powerful source, a very powerful motivation to continue to do the right thing in the world, to be kind to other people, say kind things, right? Understanding that other people, they are so sensitive to how we act. And here you have the chance to give them the gift of kind speech, give them the gift of kind actions, even give them the gift of kind thoughts. Take every opportunity, right? And with every opportunity, you are lifting yourself up. Your consciousness is becoming lighter and brighter, more joyful, more happy. Wow, what a wonderful thing that is. And the more you see that, the more you understand that in your own experience, the more motivation you get to do what is good in this world. But also the opposite, right? The negative side. See how it affects you when you do something bad. You do something negative towards somebody else, and sometimes you feel bad about it afterwards, right? You feel that it's dragging you down. Sometimes all you have to do is think a bad thought about somebody, and it feels like you're losing your energy, losing your clarity, losing your mindfulness, losing your joy. You are destroying your own happiness by being unkind to others or doing the wrong thing to others. Do you really want to sabotage your own life? Sabotage yourself? Sometimes we think, yeah, I'm going to get the other person. The only person you're getting is yourself, right? Do you really want to get yourself? Or do you want to support yourself and make sure that you have a good life and that you are moving in the right direction, so to speak? So these are very, sometimes just looking at our conditioning, looking at how these things condition us and how these things work, they can be very powerful forces for us to actually move forward on the path. You may have noticed that the suttas, they talk about different kinds of karma. They talk about the karma that ripens in this life, the karma that ripens in the next life, and the karma that ripens in future lives, right? Three types of karma are mentioned in the suttas in this way. And usually we think about karma, we think, yeah, I will have a happy rebirth in next life and all these kind of things. This is usually how we think about it. And yes, Of course, that is true and that matters. But from the perspective of the practice right now, right in this life, the kamma that matters the most for us is the ditta dhamma kamma, the kamma of this life, the kamma we experience right now. And this I understand to be, at least in part, maybe not fully, but at least in part, is the feeling of joy and happiness you get when you do an act. The joy and happiness you get in that moment, or the suffering and the negativity you get in that moment if you do something bad. That to me is the ditta dhamma kamma, the kamma you experience in this life. And this, I think, for the most of us, is the most important thing if we want to make progress right here and right now. So what I'm trying to explain here is just this sequence of conditionality, avidya, how avidya must lead to sankharas, how sankharas then affect our consciousness in this very life. Now this is not yet the consciousness of the dependent origination, because dependent origination consciousness is then how that moves into the future life, but by the sankharas establishing consciousness in this life, you know also where that consciousness is going to continue in the future life. That is how the consciousness, the vijnana, independent arising, comes about. So you establish yourself, you get this level of consciousness, high, low, somewhere in between, right? And then when you die, you continue there where you started off, or where you ended off, rather, in the previous life. So, I hope that makes a little bit of sense to you, what I'm talking about. I hope maybe a little bit more detailed than what I was talking about the other night. So, of course, what we should also probably talk about here as well, which is an important aspect of this, is also the cessation part, right? How does the cessation part work? How does this whole process come to cease? This is also an important part of this. So, of course, when the avidya is then uprooted, the avidya is gone because you have practiced the Eightfold Path in the right way, then you don't really think that there is an happiness to be had in the world anymore. You're no longer searching in the kama loka, in the world of sensuality, for sensual pleasures. You no longer have any desire for existence as such. You don't think that existence is great, right? You understand, in fact, that existence is problematic. If you keep on continuing in samsara, you're just continuing on this meaningless treadmill, going around and around, never actually going anywhere here. So avidya shows you, is the understanding that we're talking about before today. The five khandhas are problematic. The five khandhas are suffering. The cessation, the ending of the five khandhas is good. Ending of five khandhas is equivalent to the ending of existence itself. So because of that, you're no longer creating any sankharas. Sankharas are always about trying to create happiness for yourself in the future, right? Looking forward to the karma, the pleasures of life, looking forward to a new existence. Yes, I'm going to go to heaven and enjoy myself in heaven, right? All of these things, this is what the karmic activities are doing for you. And they are, so in this case, you stop doing all of that. And because you stop doing all of that, consciousness is no longer established in any of those realms. The sankharas are no longer looking to, yes, I will find happiness here. If you think you will find happiness there, then it's like you're pointing towards, you're aiming towards that particular type of existence. If you find happiness somewhere else, like in the jhana realms, your consciousness is aiming, its purpose is the jhanic existence. But now, there is no purpose anymore. There's no aiming anymore. And because there's no aiming anymore, consciousness is no longer established in any of these areas whatsoever. No establishment of consciousness. Because there's no establishment of consciousness, it's not standing in anything. When you die, it doesn't project itself forward into any renewed existence. It just stops right there. And this is how then it comes to cease. I will show you a sutta in a couple of minutes and how this actually works out. Another way of looking at this whole picture I've just been talking about now, you will notice we talk about two things there. One is the accumulation of karma. You accumulate karma, good and bad, and then your consciousness gets an establishment according to that, right? This is one thing here. And that accumulation of karma gives a color to consciousness, a quality to consciousness, and that quality is then what continues into the future here. Right? And the other one is, of course, the aim of the mind, the sankharas, the aim. You want to indulge in pleasures. You want to indulge in meditation or whatever it is. That is the other aspect. So these are the two aspects that determine rebirth, is the aiming of the mind through where you want to go, the purpose, right? The sankharas, thinking about the future, thinking about where you want to go, and the accumulated karma. And those two together, merge together, and then decide the outcome of that. So the karma is like the quality of consciousness, whether it's high or low. The sankharas is the desires of the heart that point you towards any of these realms. Okay, so that those first couple of links, really, maybe you could even say the third link a little bit as part of that. And now I want to show you a sutta which basically says exactly this. And it's a nice sutta from the Nidana Samyutta. And it is called Volitions. There's obviously quite a few suttas called Volition. This is another Chaitanya Samyutta. This is a set of three suttas that are very similar, found in the Nidana Samyutta. And they all have the same kind of idea of how the how rebirth arises from sankhara, essentially. And this is how it goes. At Savati, because what one intends and what one plans and what one has a tendency towards, this becomes the basis for the maintenance of consciousness. When there is a basis, there is a support for the establishing of consciousness. When consciousness is established and has come to growth, there is inclination. When there is inclination, there is coming and going. When there is coming and going, there is the passing away and being reborn. When there is the passing away and being reborn, future birth, old age and death, sorrow, lamentation, pain, displeasure and despair come to be. Such is the origin of this whole mass of suffering here. Right? So here we're starting off with, at the beginning, we're starting off about intending. Intending is cheti in Pali, related to chetana. Planning here is a sankapeti or pakapeti. The various recensions in Pali differ a little bit, but either one of those, I prefer sankapeti. It means to plan. It's related to sankapa, right? The idea of aiming towards something, planning for something, having a purpose in life. And whatever one has a tendency towards. So this is kind of the underlying tendencies of the mind. Even if you're not actively intending anything, there's always an underlying tendency where the mind is aiming towards. So this is sankhara, right? This is all about sankharas right there. The word, I didn't actually discuss the word sankhara very much, and maybe I should have done that. In the suttas, the word sankhara is essentially used as the way chaitana is used. It basically means chaitana. It means the activities of the mind. It means the willing of the mind, the volition of the mind. That's what it actually means. And it's specifically defined as such in a couple of suttas. In the later Abhidhamic thought, sankhara has this large number of mental qualities that are classed under sankharas. And fair enough, all of those mental qualities have some aspect of chaitana probably involved in them. So we have vitakka, vichara, manasikara, all of these things are classed under chaitana under sankhara in the Abhidhamma. But really, in the suttas, it is much simpler than that. It's only classified as or defined as chaitana itself. So it means the willing of the mind, right? That's what sankhara means. And if you look at the word sankhara itself, sang plus karoti, karoti means to do or to act. The prefix sang often has this idea of things coming together. So it means almost like putting together, right? Sankhara, putting together. Which is the same as producing or creating, right? So it's all this creating activity of the mind, sankhara, making things, producing things. And of course, that is one of those very fundamental ideas in Buddhism. We are creating the future by acting out the chaitana here and now. So we are making, producing the future, producing our own existence, producing future existence by through the chaitanas. And I think that is an important point that sometimes is overlooked, that in the suttas, sankhara, I should also say that sankhara means different things in different contexts. What I'm talking about now is the context of dependent origination, the context of the five khandhas. In those contexts, it means chaitana. In other contexts, like sabbe sankhara anicca, sabbe sankhara dukkha, it means all conditioned phenomena, all phenomena that have come into existence. And other times, it even has slightly other meanings, but certainly in these contexts, that's what it means. So this is why this is sankhara, right? Cetati is the same thing as sankharas. And when you, so all of these things that you plan and you do and you intend, they become the basis, he says here, for the maintenance of consciousness. Vijnana tittya. I was talking about the vijnana tittis yesterday. Vijnana tittya, the level of consciousness, if you like. The level of consciousness is decided here by those sankharas. This is what this is essentially saying. So whatever you do, however you intend, wherever your mind tends to hang out, right? You reflect, you look at your life, you look at your mind, you see that your mind is mostly interested in sensual things, right? You're thinking about your relatives, you're thinking about all the fun things you're going to do, right, when you get back home or whatever it is. You can see that your mind is hanging out in a certain area, and that is where it is intending. That's where it is planning for the future, what it's going to do to ensure a sufficient amount of sensual pleasures. So that is where your consciousness is hanging out. It's a level of consciousness. So that is the level of consciousness. So when there is that level, the word basis here is the same word again, pretty much. So there is the support for, actually basis here is actually aramana, and the support for establishing consciousness is basically the same word again, the vijnana titti. So it's just repeating itself. And when consciousness is established and has come to growth, there is inclination. Right? So when consciousness is established in the sensual realm, that is what you're interested in, that's where your cravings are. It comes to growth there. And the idea of growth in Buddhism is just the idea of continuing to making karma. If you make karma, if you continue acting things out, you grow either in positive qualities or you grow in bad qualities or in neutral qualities. You're making a heap of karma, and this is the idea of coming to growth. Right? Virulhi is the idea of expanding this massive store of karma, so it keeps you driving on in samsara for a long time in the future. So this is the idea of growth, right? It can be good growth, bad growth. Growth doesn't here have a positive connotation. It just has the idea that you are continuously building up under consciousness, so we'll keep on going for a long time. And when there is growth, there is inclination. Right? Depending on the kind of karma you are making, the mind will incline in a certain way here. If you make bad karma, if you do bad things, the mind will be lower down. It will incline towards lower qualities, to bad things. If you're building yourself up, lifting things up, lightening the mind, then of course you will be inclining towards those good things instead. The mind will be pointing in that direction, heading in that direction. And then, because the mind is inclining in a certain way, that is where you get reborn in the future. Right? You're heading towards these things in the future because of the inclination of that mind. When there is coming and going, and when there is coming and going, there is passing away and being reborn. I'm not sure exactly what the difference is between those things. And when there is the passing away and being reborn, future birth, old age, sorrow, old age and death, sorrow, lamentation, pain, displeasure and despair come to be. Such is the origin of this whole mass of suffering. So this is pretty much what I was talking about before, but here coming straight from the Buddha itself, in a very kind of compressed form, and it can be quite hard to know exactly what is going on. Just as a very small side issue, perhaps, I always wonder what all this coming and going really means in this particular situation. The mind is inclining somewhere. Because it is inclining somewhere, there is coming and going. It is mentioned here before passing away and being reborn. And I'm not sure exactly what it refers to, but sometimes these little cryptic things, they could refer to things that are lost from the tradition, lost perhaps from the Theravada tradition as such. And one possibility is that it could perhaps refer to the intermediate state, right, an antrabhava. I have always found that when I read the suttas, it was very clear to me that there is such a thing as an antrabhava according to the suttas. I think it's fairly, to me, it looks like the Buddha is talking about those things, even though the subsequent Theravada idea is that there is no antrabhava. To me, it looks like the suttas actually talk about that. And there's a lot of evidence for that, and maybe we can talk about that later on if people are interested. But this is a sort of thing that perhaps could be mentioned here. I'm not sure. The evidence is very weak. It's very hard to say one way or the other, but it certainly is a possibility here. And one of the nice things about the antrabhava, if you hear about people's experiences, a near-death experience and these kind of things, it sort of seems to suggest that the idea of antrabhava is also roughly the kind of corresponds to the kind of experience people often have. Anyway, let's leave that aside for now, because perhaps we're getting a little bit too sidetracked, otherwise we lose our thread. Let us now look at the other aspects of this sutta. If bhikkhus, one does not intend and one does not plan, but one still has a tendency towards something, this becomes the basis for the maintenance of consciousness. When there is a basis, there is support for the establishing of consciousness. When consciousness is established and has come to growth, there is inclination. When there is inclination, there is coming and going. When there is coming and going, there is passing away and being reborn. When there is passing away and being reborn, future birth, old age and death, sorrow, lamentation, pain, displeasure and despair come to be. Such is the origin of this whole mass of suffering. So this is just pointing out the minimum requirement for rebirth to happen. Even if you don't actively intend anything or plan anything, the fact that the underlying tendencies are still there, the anusayas, right? The anusayas, which are talked about in certain suttas, Majjhima 63, is that right? The Mahamalunkya Sutta or something like that. So as long as the underlying tendencies are there, as long as those basic, those things, that kind of, even though they're not activated, if there's a root problems are still inside of you, that will also drive the rebirth in the future. So for example, if you are getting into the jhana states, right, and then when you die, you're incredibly peaceful. Even though you have no direct intention when you die at that point, your mind is already inclining towards the jhanas, because the mind automatically moves to where it finds happiness, even if you don't have any particular intentions yourself. So it's not sufficient just to give up all intending. You can't really do that anyway, but that is not actually enough. And then we have the last one, which is what happens when you give up all of these things. But because when one does not intend and one does not plan and one does not have a tendency towards anything, no basis exists for the maintenance of consciousness. When there is no basis, there is no support for the establishing of consciousness. When consciousness is unestablished and does not come to growth, there is no inclination. When there is no inclination, there is no coming and going. When there is no coming and going, there is no passing away and being reborn. When there is no passing away and being reborn, future birth, old age and death, sorrow, lamentation, pain, displeasure, and despair cease. Such is the cessation of this whole mass of suffering. So when you give up all the intentions, including the underlying tendencies, right? consciousness is no longer established anywhere. Consciousness doesn't have any direction anymore. Consciousness doesn't have anything that it's interested in. It's not interested in existence of any type. And because of that, it's not colored by the fact that some volition wants you to exist. All that coloring, the quality of consciousness has completely disappeared. There's nothing there to hold it up anymore. Consciousness is free of all of that, not interested in any type of existence whatsoever. So because of that, it doesn't come to growth, right? The growth, the building up of karma depends on where consciousness, what consciousness is interested in. If consciousness has no interest in anymore, if it isn't colored by any type of direction, purpose, aim, then there is no growth. You no longer accumulate in karma. And in fact, the old karma becomes defunct at the same time. And then, because of that, you're not heading anywhere. There is no future passing away and being reborn. You're not heading anywhere anymore. Consciousness is no longer projecting itself into the future because you have no craving. You're not looking forward to anything. All that stuff has just disappeared and come to an end. And because of that, you will not get reborn. And when you don't get reborn, that itself is the cessation of this whole mass of suffering. So, there you are. So the main point that I've been trying to kind of talk about here, all the philosophical aspects about how sankharas kind of drive vijnana and whether this leads to rebirth or not, they are not really so important. What is important with this whole thing is basically to understand how your activities always color your mind. Try to see the link between your how you live in the world, how you act in the world, the kind of ways that you act towards other people with kindness or not with kindness, and see how that affects your mind directly. And that, I think, often has a very powerful incentive, a very powerful motivation for how we live our life, and to even improve your sila even further if it isn't 100% pure already. Okay, so that is all for this afternoon. Tomorrow I'm going to have a look at an even more profound aspect of dependent arising, and that is the connection between vijnana and namarupa, because that is kind of the core thing which makes Buddhism different from all other teachings. That is where Buddhism really is the middle way between eternalism and annihilationism. And it's very interesting, it is kind of a core aspect of the Buddhist teachings. So that will then be tomorrow morning, and before that, I will see you this evening at 7 o'clock.